and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we'll hear from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She was visiting Alaska in August of 2016 and took time to speak at the Dena'ina Center. She shares with us the insights she's learned while being a member of the highest court in the country. Please excuse any audio irregularities you may hear during the program. Justice Sotomayor was walking through the audience for most of this presentation, meeting people, shaking hands, and giving hugs. Her question and answer session was hosted by the Alaska Bar Association and was moderated by Judge Morgan Kristen.
Good afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I echo Mary's remarks. My name is Susan Cox, and I'm president of the Alaska Bar Association. The Bar Association is honored to be hosting this event, and we're very happy that Justice Sonia Sotomayor is sharing a little of her Alaska vacation time with all of us. The format today will be... The format today will be a question and answer conversation. Judge Morgan Kristen will be asking Justice Sotomayor questions that were previously submitted to the bar office. There will be no questions from the floor. By way of very brief introduction, our moderator, Judge Morgan Kristen, has served on both the state and federal judiciaries. After a career in private practice, she was appointed to the Superior Court bench in Anchorage in 2001, and in 2009, she became only the second woman in Alaska history to be appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court. Four years ago, Judge Kristen was appointed to a seat on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court that covers all the western states, becoming the first Alaskan woman to sit on that court. We are very much appreciative of Judge Kristen. We very much appreciate Judge Kristen's involvement in this event. Justice Sonia Sotomayor is a role model who has had an illustrious career that would take me more than the time available to adequately describe. I'll just mention a few highlights. Justice Sotomayor grew up in a family of Puerto Rican descent in the Bronx borough of New York City. She graduated summa cum laude from Princeton University at a time when relatively few women students and fewer Latinos were in the Princeton student body. After graduating from Yale Law School, she worked as an assistant district attorney prosecuting crimes in New York City and later worked in private practice doing commercial litigation, as well as teaching as an adjunct faculty member at NYU and Columbia Law Schools. In 1992, she was appointed to the federal trial court in the Southern District of New York. When that happened, she was the youngest judge on that court, the first Hispanic federal judge in New York State, and the first Puerto Rican woman to serve as a judge in any United States federal court. 5 years later, she was appointed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In 2009, Sonia Sotomayor made history when she became the first Hispanic and the third woman to sit on the United States Supreme Court. To date, only four women have ever served as United States Supreme Court justices, and for those who are not familiar, there are currently three women on the court out of nine seats. Justice Sotomayor has been a trailblazer and an inspiration. She's broken down barriers and championed diversity. Justice Sotomayor is particularly engaged in outreach to young people, and it's wonderful to see so many young people here today. We are privileged to have the opportunity to hear from Justice Sotomayor. Please join me in welcoming her.
Welcome to Alaska.
I love it. I've been here now since the Friday before last. I took a cruise to the Hubbard Glacier. Mm-hmm. I've been to the Arctic. I've been to Denali. I have been to Seward and Sea Life, which is amazing. If there's a young person here who has, and even an old person like me, if you haven't been there, you should go. It's been an incredible experience for me.
I heard you went to Ketchikan and did not get rained on, which is
exactly
an incredible experience.
All of the residents there were asking me not to leave.
Yes, get a little charm, a good luck charm. Well, you can't imagine how glad we are that you chose to come to Alaska for your summer vacation, and so fortunate that you're willing to give us a day from your vacation. Thank you so much. As you can see, very much anticipated. And we first heard that you were going to Fairbanks only. You can imagine we were devastated.
Well, wait a minute. They asked me.
Well, there is that, I suppose. But anyway, thank you so much for squeezing in a stop here. And thanks, Susan Cox, too, for that very nice job with the introductions. But there's one more person I must introduce because he is so close to our hearts here. A very special Alaskan. He's sitting right there. His name is Vic Fisher. And so the reason we love him and he gets a standing ovation, there are many reasons. And by the way, his wife, Jane Ann Vic, also is here. And they're very important Alaskans because of, and there are a lot of other important Alaskans in the room too. But these two have been very important community builders in our very young state. And Vic was the youngest delegate to our state's constitutional convention. And you just don't get to meet delegates to constitutional conventions very often.
I don't get to meet founding fathers.
There's one right there. And so that's why the standing ovation.
Thank you for
ovation.
Being here.
All right. There's about 1,000 people here, I think, or maybe even more from what Mary had to say. And I'm guessing that most of them have read your book. I certainly have. I noticed that you borrowed...
The public library has it.
I noticed that you borrowed a line from a poem... for the title of your book, and I'm wondering if you would mind reading that poem.
Absolutely. Forgive the exile, this sweet frenzy. I return to my beloved world, in love with the land where I was born. And this is a quote from a Puerto Rican author entitled José Gautier Benítez, and the title of the poem is To Puerto Rico I Return.
Thank you. It's a beautiful poem. Why did you choose that line from that poem for your book?
For those of you who have read my book, I made a great attempt to ensure that I spoke honestly about the good and the bad in my life. And to do that, I had to be partly objective, but subjective in how people and places that I've been have influenced me. At the end of the book, I realized, because it was a process of examining not just the facts of my life, but the emotions of my life. That's what I try to share with you in my book, that I loved my life, and that I am so grateful to everyone who's played a part, by the way, some good, some bad, in forming me. And it was my editor who said to me, it would be really nice if we could find a quote that would reflect the emotions that you exhibit in this book, that you share with others. And we both started reading that book of poetry. And believe it or not, the next morning, I called him and I said, the title of my book is My Beloved World. And he said, that's exactly what I thought. So it shows that that I had succeeded enough to convince my editor that that was the right title for the book.
I think it is safe to say that most judges are introverts and do not write books like this book, with personal stories, very poignant stories. And I wondered about whether the process that you just described and reliving that history, was that a difficult process for you?
Well, let me explain why I started and or embarked on this. And it was my predecessor, Justice Souter, I took his spot on the court, who, after a couple of years after writing the book, said to me, "I think you use the book to escape the overwhelming emotion about getting on the court that every new justice experiences." And I said, "Truly? I had no idea that every new justice had felt so overwhelmed by the experience as I did." And I was sharing that with him 2 or 3 years after I got to the court. And he said, "Yes, you use the book as your own therapy to deal with what was happening to your life. You have to understand, you get nominated to the Supreme Court, and it's like a rocket ship that takes you to the moon. And it doesn't take you back. Your life gets changed forever. And I wanted to hold on to who I was. I wanted to ensure that I never forgot where I came from and the people who were a part of that journey with me. You know, this kind of attention can be very seductive. And you've heard the old adage, power corrupts absolutely. Power can corrupt absolutely, and I know that. And so the book was my attempt to hold on to Sonia. And it wasn't difficult, because that was its purpose at the bottom or the core. It was, as I tell my friends, if I get too stuck up in the air, take that heavy book and hit me over the head with it.
Friends and family are good at that, I think.
Yeah, oh, they're really wonderful at that.
Good.
They
uh-huh.
are. They
yeah,
are.
Good. You seem to have mastered the art from a very young age of asking for help when you needed help and looking for role models, finding them, going out and looking for them. That's something that, that struck me. When did you realize that people looked to you as a role model?
It was shocking, actually. The day I was nominated, my then 20-odd-year-old niece, I'm now losing track of her age, okay? But I think she was just 20, about to be 21, sent me a text message that said, "Titi," Titi is aunt in Spanish, "you're a rock star." And I looked at the person with me and said, "Is that a good thing?" And they said, "Oh yeah, it is." And I thought to myself, "Oh boy, what have I gotten myself into?" I don't know. I know when it happened. And it wasn't on the Supreme Court. There was this couple in New York City who had rooftop parties where they invited people they had come across in all sorts of different ways. So at one of their rooftop parties, they could have a homeless person and the mayor of the city of New York. Mm-hmm. And I get an invitation from them to come join this group of young Hispanic women, professionals. And I thought, I've read about this rooftop activity, I'll go. I show up. And there's a group of about 6 of us that were my friends, my contemporaries, women that I have lived with in my life in the city. And we're sitting, greeting each other, talking to each other. And all of a sudden, all these young women started to surround us. And they're all asking us questions. And I had a light bulb go off where I realized I wasn't there as a young Hispanic leader. I was an old Hispanic leader. Do you know I went through a trauma for about 6 months? It was like, oh, wait a minute. That self-image of being young got turned around. But it was that moment that I realized that unbeknownst to me, mm-hmm. I had become a role model to others.
You certainly are.
I do something that others don't, but before I do it, I have to explain one thing. See all these people standing up in suits? They got little things in their ears.
The ear, yeah.
Most of them are here for purposes of my security, but not from you, but from me. Because they don't like what I'm about to do, I'm going to get off the stage and go walk among you. Because there are people on that end of the room and people in the back and in the middle who could see me like a little dot on the top of the stage. And if you've made the effort to stand online and come visit with me, I think you're entitled at least to see what I look like and not through the lens of a television. So I'm going to walk around. The only thing you can't do is get up unexpectedly. They get nervous, okay? So if you stay in your seat, I might pause, shake your hand. I even give out hugs occasionally. But please don't stand up. How's that? And they'll leave us alone.
Good? I don't think I can walk and read. So I'm going to stay here. Is that okay?
That's okay.
All right, let me know if you can't hear me. We'll try this. All right, so my next question is about your openness. You've spoken and written about how alcoholism affected your family as a child, how diabetes affected your family as a child. And as I prepared for today, I was struck by how different our conversation would be if you had not written your book. So my question is, have there been times when you missed your privacy or had second thoughts about being so open with your story?
I miss my privacy a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I am an extrovert in nature. I love people, if you haven't figured that out yet. And so it's not that I don't enjoy being with people. And talking with them and engaging with them. But how do I describe it to kids? I went from being a person that could choose when I wanted to be in the front of the classroom or the back of the classroom, that could walk the streets and observe people and look at their lives and look at them and learn just from observing, to a person who's always in the front of the room. And I'm no longer given a choice. I go to public places like restaurants, and I have seen people take cell phones and be at the edge of their table with the cell phone picking up, and just as I'm about to put the fork in my mouth. And I'll just put the fork down, look at them, and shake my head no. And I had a young person ask me one day, so what do you have to hide? What do you care? And it's not a sense of hiding anything. It's a sense of all of us live wanting to share, to be our own person, to walk and look and stop when we choose and just experience life on our terms. And I don't have that anymore. And yes, I do miss it. But I also think one of the benefits of writing my book has been that people are respectful on some levels. When I'm in a store and someone comes up to me to say, can I take a picture with you? I will often say, you know, I'd love to, but could you let me finish my shopping first? And if you wait outside, I'll meet you outside. Half the people wait, but I'll always take the picture with the person who waits. That I do miss. I miss New York City, my home. I miss being able on the spur of the moment to join the family when they're having an event. They haven't, even after 7 years, gotten used to planning things far enough in advance for my life anymore. And so when I get really upset, I call up and tell them, you don't care about me. And they scramble and we try to find the time that we can do things together. My mother's been sick and I've been in court, and she lives in Florida, so being there has been difficult. Those are moments where the price of public service seems the heaviest to carry. But no, the intent of my book, and I describe it in my preface, was the hope that if some people who read it took hope into their own lives about what they could do and withstand and still succeed, then the book was worthwhile. And I think that I've gotten enough feedback from people who have told me that it's helped them in those ways to think that it was worth doing.
As you travel, there, I want to tell you, because I know you love kids, that we are blessed to have a group of youth court lawyers and judges with us today, but I don't know where they are, and I wonder if they could stand up. Oh, okay. When you get close, I'll tell you, okay? You're not close yet. There they are, though.
A bunch of you were at... I found out what the youth court was at about 1 o'clock. I met in the public library with the Girl Scouts, mm-hmm. who invited a group of the young judges and lawyers from the youth court. And what a great enterprise
that is. It is a great enterprise. And so, and in our state, our youth court, we have youth lawyers, prosecutors and defense attorneys, but they're also the judges, which is unique in Alaska. And so we're very, very proud of them.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do.
People remember your confirmation process to the Supreme Court because it was so publicized, as you have mentioned. But you also had a confirmation process to the Second Circuit that was very lengthy and very difficult and had nothing to do with your qualifications or with you, really. It had to do with a lot to do with politics. So I wonder, did you think twice about accepting the nomination?
Twice, three times, four times, five times. There was actually a point in the process where I almost pulled out. And it was the being hit over the head with a bat by two and three of my closest friends that stopped me from doing it.
Thank goodness.
It is hard to describe to people how painful it can be when you're in the public eye the way a nomination brings you, and where your reputation is attacked. I had built a lifetime of working hard, making friends at the jobs that I had, of trying to treat people with dignity and respect. And yet I was reading about how assertive I was. Now, they didn't use the word assertive. How harsh I was and how tough I was, and that I really wasn't smart. And all of this stuff that just got to my stomach. There's a point at which you can take a certain amount of it, and others where you say, it's really worth destroying a lifetime of what I had thought was a great reputation. And so, yes, I had a lot of second thoughts. This process of taking nominees and not getting to the issues that are important to you, but trying to bring them down with innuendo and with insults, it's not helpful to the process. You know, there is no question that certain people thought and think that I will not judge in the way they would like me to judge, but that says little about whether I'm qualified to judge or not. And so I thought that that was the purpose of the nomination process, not to judge the outcome of my judging, but to judge the process. Do I know how to be a judge? And when that attention was not focused on that, but on other things, it became exceedingly painful. But as I said, and it is something I do in my entire life, I remember that I need friends to talk to before I act on fear and hurt. Because I think that those feelings, both fear and hurt, drive all of us to bad decisions. And so it's more important to recognize them when you're experiencing them and when they're leading you to say no to things that you shouldn't or should think about saying no to. And so I did share it with a few of my friends. And as I said, I got hit over the head with a baseball bat.
Hello, Justice, what surprised you most when you joined the Supreme Court?
What surprised me the most? You know, I'd been a judge for 17 years, so judging could not have been a surprise to me. And judges struggle to do their work. It's not easy to be asked. All right, who has a camera here?
Right here.
All right.
When you're ready, get set. Oh, beautiful.
How old are you?
8.
All right, if you're under 8, you can ask me for a picture. I had not realized how much comfort I took being a trial judge and being an appellate judge from the fact that there was always a court above me that could fix my worst mistakes. You know, when I got to the district court, in fact, my then chief judge said to me, "Sonia, remember something. Most litigants don't really care, in important cases, don't really care what you think. They're just priming their case for the courts above. So you're just better off really fast rather than delaying them from getting to the people you want to get to." And there's actually some truth to that. I suspect that most of the lawyers in this room understand that sentiment. But I didn't appreciate until I got to the court how much decision-making could burden me now. And the reason for that, for me, is rather self-evident. We're the last court. And yes, Congress can fix some of the things we do wrong, okay? If we get an interpretation of a statute wrong, Congress can change law. But if we get the Constitution wrong, they can't. And even getting Congress to agree on addressing laws that they've already passed and revisiting them is very, very hard. So whatever decision we make as a court, its consequences are around for a very long time. And even when I think and know I'm right, because you can't vote on a case unless you really feel you're right, I also know that with every winner of a case, what's the obverse? There's a loser. Every case the Supreme Court renders affects some people in a positive way, and it affects other people in a negative way. And so that sense of the finality of what we do was really bigger than I ever anticipated. And I'm not one not to make decisions. It's, you know, part of my personality. That's why I became a judge, I think. But I am also very cognizant that of what we do both in its positive and negative ways.
Thank you for tuning in to Addressing Alaskans here on KSKA Anchorage. You are listening to a conversation with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She's answering questions at an event held at the Dena'ina Center in August of 2016. The questions are being moderated by Judge Morgan Christen of the Ninth Circuit Court.
There's about 40% of the people here, I think, are lawyers, and the rest, I think, are not, or thereabouts. Anyway, there's a whole lot
That's
of folks
wonderful,
here.
Actually.
And it's
Thank
so
you.
Great. And I just wanted to welcome all the people who came from the public who aren't lawyers. Not the lawyers are, of course, welcome as well, but we're so thrilled that there's such great public participation. It's
but wait a minute.
Wonderful.
Thank the lawyers. They put it together.
Well, did we do that already? I don't know. Maybe we should have. If we haven't, thank you as well. And that's wonderful
you.
News.
Thank
but this next question is for the lawyers, and that is that was very surprising to hear to realize that the Supreme Court has an interval, a way of scheduling their oral arguments. So the conferencing for that case is not on the same day. That's quite different from the way the Alaska Supreme Court handles its arguments. It's certainly different from the way the Ninth Circuit schedules its cases. So I wonder, could you explain that scheduling and how that works?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about how we do our work, okay? Anywhere from 6 weeks to 12, except for the summer, because we could get some briefs earlier in the summer. I'm already preparing for the arguments in October. So we've had the briefs for a little longer than that period of time. Justices get the briefs in their office. We are, with our law clerks, reading those briefs and preparing for oral argument, thinking about the issues, thinking about what we don't understand and what questions we can ask. And so we're preparing for that argument. But the one thing we're not doing is we're not talking to each other about the arguments. We're not talking about the cases. In virtually every case, there's some minor exceptions, and the exceptions have to do with a justice noticing something important, like, what are the parties doing here? There's no jurisdiction for us to hear the case. Or some justice realized, this case may be moot. And so a question like that, we might share with each other, because fundamental to the case, and to whether it's there or not, or whether it stays with us or not. But outside of that, we're not talking about the case. The first time we talk about the case among ourselves is at oral argument. Now that's strange for me to say, right, to you lawyers? We should be talking to you, right? Well, that's not the purpose of oral argument. The purpose of oral argument is for us as a group to be talking about our reactions to your arguments. If your briefs are not clear enough, haven't made your case, you should go back to law school. No, seriously. If we don't understand your best arguments from your brief, you have failed at what you have to do. You have to get us thinking. And we have to understand what it is that persuades you that you're right. And so what we're doing in oral argument is answering whatever lingering questions we have, but we're also sharing with each other our views of the case. And doing it in a way where we're engaging with you about those views. And so that's why in a lot of oral arguments, you'll almost see a conversation through the lawyer, but with each other. Because that's exactly what we're doing. We're sharing our thinking process about what's happening and what's being said. Now, that almost inevitably, in many cases, not all obviously, but in many, will lead people to go back to their offices and do something like Justice Kennedy, me to my law clerks, okay? Justice Kennedy asked this question. I'm troubled by it. Let's go back and rethink this, and let me look at the cases or that he's looking at or the issue more closely. And every chambers, in some form or another, it may not be asking exactly that same question, but is asking for follow-up research on something that was said at oral argument. And before I go to vote, and I think it is true for most of my colleagues, they've had a very extensive discussion with their law clerks about what was said and what it means to the evaluation of the case. And so that's why we don't vote the same day of argument, because we really want to be able to reflect on whatever new views or new information was gleaned from the oral argument. But we vote fairly close to the oral argument. For the cases we hear on Monday, and there's usually two cases we hear a day, occasionally we'll hear a third. On most mornings, we're hearing cases from 10 to 12. If we have a third case, it's from 1 to 2, because we always eat lunch from 12 to 1. I had to get used to the regularity of the Supreme Court. It's not within me to be that structured, but I got broken in, okay? At any rate, those cases we vote on Wednesday afternoon. And the cases we've heard on Tuesday and Wednesday, we vote on Friday mornings. And so the decision making is that same week, but it's always after a period of reflection.
And during that interval, the huddling you're doing and the follow-up discussion, that's in silos within your chambers, is that right?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Well, just in that interval, the process you just described, that's you're doing that still just within your own chambers, is that
no,
right?
Not necessarily.
Sometimes
the justices will be talking to each other.
Interesting.
You know, if someone raised something that piqued another justice's interest, it's not unheard of for you to pick yourself up and go talk to that justice. Mm-hmm. That, we do confer among each other on occasion. It's not always, but there is some communication before conference. But it is important for all of us to sense that we're going in to vote, that we have a clear idea of what we're doing.
Great. I canvassed some kids and asked them some questions, asked them four questions, and they look better than some of mine, so I'm going to go... to a couple of theirs, so I make sure that we don't run out of time. The first one, I think, assumes a fact, not an evidence. But the first one asks, are you Ravenclaw, Hufflepuff, or Gryffindor?
Gryffindor. I'm an extrovert. Thank you.
I like that they assumed that you're not Slytherin. That was good.
I have to tell you, I ended up reading Harry Potter because I went to dinner with some friends, and their then 12-year-old and 8-year-old children were in the midst of reading one of the volumes, and both came to me and said, Sonia, you have to read Harry Potter. And so I thought about it, and I went on a trip of all places to the Galapagos. Has anybody ever gone? You're sailing a very long time. I read 4 volumes on that sail and came back about a week before the 5th came out, and I joined that long line of people who pre-bought the book.
Great. Well, some of the younger members of our audience have read that at least in years past, male members of the Supreme Court have sometimes passed notes with things like baseball scores, maybe the baseball scores from the World Series and whatnot on occasion. So the question is, do the women justices pass notes too? And if so, what are yours about?
Not with the frequency the men do. And The first time that I announced an opinion, the very first opinion I wrote for the Supreme Court, Justice Ginsburg sent me a note congratulating me. And that was just so touching. Occasionally, I will pass notes to Steve Breyer, who sits immediately to, now he's sitting to my right. We switched mid-year. Steve Breyer loves to talk. When you come into the courtroom, you'll see him whispering to Justice Thomas. They're always talking about the cases, okay? But occasionally, I gotta overhear what they're saying, so I'll put my two cents in a note. But we don't do it with the frequency the guys do it. I am told by Sissy Marshall that when she was there with the other wives, that the justices would send notes to the wives. Something like, what did he have for dinner last night? He's in a grouchy mood today. and so, or they would play with each other. I don't know that I've seen any of the women do that with the wives who might sit in the box. So, but yes, note writing is still alive and present on the Supreme Court.
You have written that your entire approach to prosecuting changed and that you never lost a case after you learned to leverage emotional intelligence. So the question is, how did emotional intelligence change your approach to litigating?
Let me describe what happened. I had a more senior attorney beat me back to back on two cases against the same defendant. And I was devastated. So I went to my supervisor, a long-standing attorney, and you too. Thank you. I said, Warren, I did wrong. And he said, tell me what the cases were about. Tell me how you argued them and what you did. So I proceeded very analytically to tell him exactly what I did. And at the end, he looked at me and he said, to me, Sonia, how did you convince the jury that they had to convict this man? I said, what do you mean? I laid out the evidence. It proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. They should have. And he looked and he said, you know, most people don't want to judge other people. It's not within us. Jump up and convict people. It's your job not only to prove he's guilty, but to convince the jury that it's their obligation to find him guilty. And this very traditional, tough prosecutor said to me, there is emotion in the process of persuasion. You have to touch not only people's head, but their heart too. You have to take them and show them that what you're asking them to do is the right thing. And that bit of advice turned things completely around. I never got another acquittal in 20 plus cases after that. I got one or two hung juries, but never another acquittal. And it was learning to talk to juries both about their obligation as jurors to find the facts and to convict if they were convinced the facts were proven. I also learned how to tell stories. You see, because every crime is a story. So it's not just a computer spitting out the evidence or the facts. It's telling the story of that crime, making it interesting. I often, when I was a judge, would get prosecutors who were like me, and I would try to explain to them, I don't know if it works all the time. And I'm not sure all of them really understood. But there is an art to talking to people and really convincing them. And I think that that art needs that emotional component and the intellectual. Because you can't convince them to do something that the evidence doesn't prove is the right thing to do. But you have to take them to where you want them to be. It was a critical, critical lesson for me. I loved being a trial lawyer. I loved being a trial judge. I have said publicly, and I repeat here, when and if, no panic, okay? When and if I retire, I'm not going to sit on the Court of Appeals. I'm going back to try cases.
Yeah. Hello. Okay, I'm turning the page now to questions from the public. Okay? The first question is, why does diversity on the bench matter?
Thank you. Now, let me start by saying to you that I don't define diversity by ethnicity or gender alone. So when I'm giving you my answer, don't pigeonhole it into thinking that that's the narrowness of diversity that's important on the bench. We are being asked as judges to decide the legal issues that are perplexing every person, business, government, enterprise, not just in the United States, but sometimes in the world. You're asking us to decide issues that vex you, that many of you have been living and studying most of your professional lives. And so you're asking a judge to become a master of basically every human endeavor there is. We have to become a specialist enough to answer the questions the experts can't. And so if you want us to be able to do that, I think you want people involved in the enterprise who have actually really know as much about the world as they can. You want people with as much life experience in as many fields as judging as an enterprise can have. And for example, I worry a lot about our Supreme Court today. We have all Ivy Leaguers, myself included. We have four New Yorkers. Okay. We have people from Washington, D.C. and New Jersey. We have one Californian and one Georgian. And that's all we have. We have nobody from the Midwest. We have no Protestants. We don't have anybody except Catholics and Jews. Is that a bad thing? No. But is it enough for a court that's being asked to judge everything that comes through the legal system throughout the United States? I don't think so. By my druthers, I think that the variety of both professional and life experiences helps to ensure that when we're talking and conferencing cases, that we're not missing anything. There is an example I'll use. A few years ago, we had a case involving searches of cell phones. And when it was legal for the police to do it or not do it. And one of my colleagues basically asked a question of one of the lawyers that asked something like, who would have two cell phones? And in the context of the question, it was like, except for drug dealers or criminals, would have two cell phones. And I looked at Steve Breyer and said, the lawyer he's talking to, he's a government lawyer. He has the government phone and he has his personal phone. I have two cell phones, okay? Now, did that make a difference in how that justice ruled? No, probably not. But we never know how a misperception on a set of human circumstance, like who owns two phones, could influence somebody to think that one ruling might be better than another, or that the interests affected are just involving criminals and not the larger society. And so that is what diversity does. It ensures in our conversations that because people have diverse backgrounds, that very little in the arguments is missed, that very, very little is based on misperceptions, because there's real engagement when someone says something that other people believe is factually not accurate. And those things are born from experiences. You litigate cases, you live in this society, you learn things. And when people say things that are not quite accurate, you're able to say, that's not. And I know that those justices will go back to their law clerks and say, is that other justice right? Because that's what we all do, okay? And that's the importance of diversity. It brings to the conversation the fullness of perspectives. And it doesn't, people think that what it does is make you predisposed to vote in one way or vote in another. That's just not true. But what it does do is ensure that we're basing our decision on all of the facts.
Another question that we received reads as follows. It says,
over you, Mama.
I heard someone say, one woman in the boardroom is a token, two is a minority, three or more, and you begin to see policies shift. What difference do you imagine might exist if women had a stronger voice in the institutions in this country? And the writer put, Perrin, I guess I'm looking for a little hope.
You know, the day Elena Kagan was sworn in, the president came to visit. He did at my swearing in as well. And he went up to Justice Ginsburg and said to her, Justice, are you happy with the two sisters I've brought you? And she responded, I'm very, very happy. Pause. But I'll be happier when I have four more. Now, for the non-lawyers in this room, a majority is five justices. So four more gave her the security of five. and so that's basically what she meant. I don't know if that's true or not. I do know that there's been any number of studies that have shown that as women have gotten on the bench, decisions in certain areas of the law have changed and become fairer to women. One of the areas that's been well documented is bankruptcy law. There were many, many studies of the fact that women in bankruptcy laws were treated less favorably than men. With the advent of more women going into bankruptcy court and litigating those cases and on the bench in the bankruptcy courts, the studies have shown that there's certainly much, much more equality. The Supreme Court has never been, and I don't think completely yet, the leader in women's rights. In fact, let's remember that most equality issues have not been decided by the Supreme Court, decided by legislation. Supreme Court never decided it was unconstitutional for women not to vote. It was a law that got passed by Congress that gave women the right to vote. Would we today, if Congress were to take away that right, not find it in the Constitution? You answer that question. All right? Up until the presence of Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg, there had not been one Supreme Court case that had ever been favorable to a woman's claim. Women by the Supreme Court, we affirmed lower court decisions that kept women from practicing law, from being butchers, from doing all sorts of occupations because the court said it was unseemly. So, it wasn't the courts, it was the women's movement that really changed the rights of women. But you did have one case, the one and first case, where women's got their day in court, was the VMI military school case. The court said that not admitting women to the benefits of such an important educational experience as a military academy run by the state was unconstitutional. So there is no question in my mind that having women does in some ways change the perspective that the court might have on these issues. One day at lunch not so long ago, we were talking about, how the relationship of the court members had changed from earlier periods in the court's life, where justices were publicly known not to like each other. There was a period in the Supreme Court's history where justices actually spoke ill about each other. Some justices wouldn't even talk to the other. That has changed dramatically in the modern era. And we were just having a conversation about what caused that. And some of the male colleagues said it was this Chief Justice. Somebody attributed it to a different Chief Justice. And a little voice in the corner, that of my colleague Ruth Bader Ginsburg, said, "It's when women came to the court." There had always been a tradition of the court eating lunch together, but I explained there were ages where some justices wouldn't show up if somebody else did. When Justice O'Connor came to the court, she insisted that everybody had to come to lunch. And when Chief Justice Roberts took over his leadership of the court, Justice O'Connor would scold him if he ever missed the lunch. How does the presence of women or their absence really change things? There's some empirical academic work. And clearly, I've looked at it, that does support the notion that we make a difference in the judging enterprise. But I think overall, it is what, again, Justice Ginsburg said. In a case involving the search of a public school student, who I think was about 13, and it was a no-drug zone school. And it was reported through three levels of hearsay that the young girl was seen taking an aspirin. And the school did a search of the girl's personal body on this tripled hearsay. And the claim before us was that that was unconstitutional because A, there was no probable cause, and B, there was no reasonable basis to do that kind of private search. After the argument, Justice Ginsburg was reported to say, "I don't believe my male colleagues understand how sensitive a 13-year-old girl is about her personal privacy." She was criticized for saying that. I don't think that it had much to do with how the justices ultimately voted. But I do know that no justice wrote an opinion analogizing that search to undressing in a locker room to go to a gym class. If a justice had made the mistake of doing something like that, it would have been insulting and hurtful to so many women. And so that's part of the earlier question. What does the presence of diversity, how does it help? And sometimes it helps in just ensuring that people are sensitive about how they express themselves.
Justice, this year has been huge in the history of the court because we were so shocked by Justice Scalia's passing. This questioner writes, "How has the Supreme Court's atmosphere and working process changed in the aftermath of his death?"
It's not as quite as much fun. No, really. I've often said he was a big brother who sometimes said the most annoying things. And believe me, there were moments when he said things where I shook my head and said, "He really didn't say that, did he?" And we disagreed a lot in writing, but he was fun. And he was witty. And he was also an extrovert. We acknowledged that in each other. And he liked people. And he liked engaging with them. And he was curious about the world. So sometimes he would bring up facts that nobody else in the world ever knew. Sometimes you'd be talking about something and he's singing a ditty that was a shipyard song, turn of the century, okay? He was entertaining, gregarious, generous when he felt that you were in need. He cared. And so it is a little bit less fun without him. It was reported that shortly after his death, I had started asking too many questions. And I realized, and I had to self-examine myself, why was I doing that? And I realized it was because I was uncomfortable with the longer silences that were happening at oral argument. You know, lawyers want to be engaged at oral argument, and all of a sudden we had a lot of dead periods. And my inclination was to jump in and fill some of those holes. I had to start containing myself and start living with the slightly longer silences. As many of the lawyers here know, he was a very active participant in oral argument. He beat me generally by a lot of questions.
Your book talks about several wonderful stories about your brother and your grandmother and your mom. And this questioner asked, "What is the most important thing your family did to help you get to where you are today?"
When I was a child, I was a terror. and was always getting my cousins and I into trouble. I describe in the book the enterprise of getting my younger cousin's leg broken, because I had the really silly idea that it would be nice to put my brother on my shoulders, my cousin Nelson's brother on his shoulders, take a broom and a mop, and play like we're horses going at each other. He fell off and his leg broke. My cousin Miriam, in writing the book, admits to me that everybody in the family blamed me. I blamed myself. But it was actually her fault, because she reached out to stop the play and pulled him down, and that's when his leg broke. It took writing a book to get the story, okay? My cousins were my friends when I was little. And even to today, most of them are still very close to me. But my cousin Miriam and I were at a family party, and her daughter did something that was a little bit misbehaving. And Miriam looked at her and said, "You're as bad as Cousin Sonia was." And I had enough, okay? And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I hope she grows up like me, don't you?" That's not bad, okay? But I think, in many ways, I was a different child. I was rambunctious, and I wasn't what they were. I couldn't dance salsa. It took me till I was 50 to take lessons. And when I asked my mother, "Why didn't I learn? They all know how," she said, "Because you never sat still enough to get through a lesson of dancing." And despite how I know they think of me as being a little different than them, they've always loved me. And that gave me the freedom to be who I am. No matter what I've done, no matter what I've achieved, they've been at my side. And that gives you strength that nothing else in the world can. You really can't break loose from what are most people's and families' expectations of you unless you know that you're loved no matter what choices you make. And so for me, I am eternally grateful to my family. You know, a lot of the kids when I went to college and law school who had backgrounds similar to mine had a hard time figuring out how to bring their mother to environments like Princeton and Yale. Parents only got to them to Princeton or Yale at their graduation. And I remember thinking to myself, why? And later in years, we talked about it. They never thought their family would be comfortable. My family has been to every induction, every job I've ever had. They were there with me celebrating at the White House when the president threw me a party. And I went to the bathroom, and there was my 90-year-old aunt, basically in a wheelchair, stuffing her pocketbook with the napkins and plastic cups that had the White House logo on it, okay? I said, "Titi," and she said, "They're not gonna miss it." And my greatest consolation was last Christmas, I got invited to the White House Christmas party, and the president gets up to welcome everyone, told them to have fun, and said, "Just leave the silverware, but you can't take the napkins and the coffee cups." I think I've made it through most of the room.
You've been so much fun to talk with, and you did mention that nature is a little foreign to you, given that you were raised in a city, but that you've enjoyed visiting Alaska at least thus far. And I just...
I've loved it. Do you know I've been to at least 12 cities?
Yeah.
In Alaska?
That's a lot in Alaska.
As I... And I didn't just rush through many of them. I really got to see the places and talk to people.
So you're feeling better about nature?
I am, very
yeah.
much
Good.
So.
Good.
I don't know that I want to come back in the winter yet.
Yeah. Next time we'll get in the summer, I think. But I'll tell you, winter is my favorite time. Winter
that's what a lot time. Of people from Alaska say.
Yes.
And I met a 6 and 4-year-olds who were telling their parents that they were waiting for winter.
Uh-huh.
And I thought to myself, oh no, I'm not this crazy.
Yes, yes.
No. It's an amazing place you live in. And I can see why you have this sense of courage and independence and a sense of survival, because you really have not only survived, but made a better place for all of yourselves here. I am glad that I came. You should know that my reason for saying yes to Fairbanks, sorry, I'm not trying to rub it in, was that I had made a promise to myself when I first was sworn in that during my tenure as a justice, I would visit all 50 states. And I'm not quite there, but when I got the letter from Fairbanks, I had also been thinking about my bucket list, and Alaska and a visit to Alaska had always been on my bucket list, and it seemed a good way to do two things. I'm very grateful for the time I've spent with you. You've shown me a great deal about the really majestic nature of America.
Good.
So thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for tuning in to Addressing Alaskans here on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She spoke to an audience at the Dena'ina Center, which was sponsored by the Alaska Bar Association. I'm your host and producer of this show, Eric Bork.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.